then above 77 is when they die. So if you factor this into the average, this is super concerning, because that average is going to continue to get higher and higher. And so doing something now is crucial. And what we're doing is we're looking at cold water refuges. So these are areas where salmon can kind of go and rest, get the cold water, then continue upriver or downriver. And so creating these refuges is going to be is probably the biggest things that we'll be looking at in the next, 10, 20 years. We're already doing a lot of work now, but in order for salmon to survive, we can't cool the whole river, but we can cool certain areas of respite for the salmon to help them on their journey to and from the ocean. This is from Chief Menainik in 1915. This is Yakima. My old boss, he used to manage the wildlife program at Yakima. He said, "We must begin preparations to maintain our community and our natural resources. We must carry forward our culture and traditions for our tribe's future and for your own family's well-being. For many generations, you'll be challenged with the changing climate. But always remember, since time immemorial, we have looked to our elders for their wisdom and guidance. And with our children, we will always see hope."
That was Asia Dokoju discussing tribes and treaty rights on the Columbia River. Asia spoke as part of the Oregon High Desert Association's High Desert Speaker Series. Asia is a citizen of the Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakima Nation and serves as the Watershed Department Manager for the Columbia River Intertribe.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 11th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen The Big Sick. This screening benefits the Bus Project. Again, that's The Big Sick, showing Monday, March 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
I'm speaking today with Rima Zaman, an Oregon Literary Arts Writer of Color Fellow. Her memoir, I Am Yours, was released February 5th by Amberjack Publishing and has become a bestseller at Powell's. I Am Yours is the story of Rima's unwavering fight to protect and free her voice from those who have sought to silence her. From Bangladesh to Thailand to New York to Oregon, through gorgeous prose as beautiful as it is biting, poetic as it is political, and healing as it is haunting, Zaman explores the many difficulties, dangers, and ultimately, the necessity for all women, all people, to own and use their voices. Rima, thanks so much for being with us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of your biggest statements is that female voices are revolutionary. Why is this message so important to you?
That message is so important to me. It is the core of who I am and the core of my belief system. I believe women, we hold generations of wisdom. And even in our anger, because most of us, from the time we are young girls, we are trained to be nurturers, we are highly cognizant of the collective well-being, the well-being of a relationship at large, of a community, of a family. So anytime we rise to anger or rise to indignation, it's because we have witnessed or experienced some sort of injustice, because we can sense something is going wrong and it is hurting the ones I love. It is hurting society. It is hurting the relationship. It is hurting the whole. And so when we do rise up and we use our voices, we are speaking on behalf of so many people. We are speaking on behalf of the larger story and larger humankind. And so when we rise and claim the power of our voices, we not only ignite our own freedom, but we start to empower others as well.
Did you come to this realization recently, or is this something that you've known your whole life?
Whenever I feel something as truth, I know it as truth as well as I know my name. And from the time I was a young girl, I would just make these declarations. And I feel, because of the culture I come from. So I was born in Bangladesh and raised in Thailand, and I witnessed and experienced a lot of misogyny and indignity and violence thrown toward myself as well as the women around me. And I saw every day at least one action that was used to silence a girl or a woman in my family. And through all of this, the volume and frequency of those daily experiences made me realize the injustice of that, the systemic misogyny that plagues the planet. And it also made me realize just how unfair that is, not just on the usual level, but because women's voices, we hold so much wisdom and we hold so much beauty and strength. It's so unfair to silence our voices, because by silencing our voices, humankind is actually cutting off one of its biggest resources. And that's why we say, you know, if you empower a woman, you empower the village, you empower everyone, because a woman will, an empowered woman has that much more to give her family, that much more to give her community. We are the nucleus of a relationship, of a village, of a family, the beating heart. And I grew aware of this from the time I was a young girl, and I'm very fortunate to have grown up with an amazing mother who has always nourished my voice, even when she didn't have a voice. And because of this duality and the parallel lives we have lived, it has reinforced my conviction even more. And we have been such an extension of each other's feminism and an extension of each other's becoming. And all of that further inspires my work as a writer, as an activist, as a feminist, as a human being.
Was this female power and support, was this something that you recognized as feminism early on, or did it not have a label specifically?
It didn't have a label for me for a long time, just because I felt like this was just right. Mm-hmm. Equality for all genders, equality for all races feels right. It doesn't need a label. The heart knows its truth. Of course, I do identify as a feminist, and proudly so. But I think especially children, they don't need the labels because they know it as truth. They know it as the right thing, as the good thing.
I'd like to explore the lasting impacts of your career as a model. You've said the more pieces of myself that I lose, the more men I attract.
Mm.
Can you elaborate on what this statement has meant to you?
Yes, I have that line in I Am Yours. And so I experienced sexual trauma and sexual objectification since I was a very young girl, since I was 11. And through larger as well as smaller indignities and actions of violence, I felt myself chip away. And every piece that was abandoned or kidnapped from me, the more susceptible I became to toxic partners and toxic relationships. So that's what that means for me, where it's not that I would attract good men or allies or feminist men, but precisely the men who prey upon insecurity in women, who prey upon women who are demure and have been trained to keep their voices very small and always in service of the man in the center of their lives. And so that's what that means. And it's the effect of this culture of misogyny that all of us are exposed to. And if we're not careful, pieces of us will be chipped away. And as we grow smaller, the bullies in society become all that more attracted to us. The way to counter that and heal that is gaining the power of our voices. We break the cycle of attraction to and from bullies and from people who will prey upon those people who are insecure.
You've shared the many struggles and barriers you faced trying to report the stalking you experienced by your high school teacher. Could you speak to your story's relevance to the Me Too movement and some of the obstacles women and girls may face in their fight for justice and accountability?
Yes, thank you. So I wrote about that experience I had as a 17-year-old and 18-year-old girl in my high school at the International School of Bangkok. And I was serially exposed to verbal and written harassment and sexual harassment from my teacher there. And I had reported it to my high school principal, and I had reported it as well to a few other teachers. And no action was taken. I was told to go back to school, go back to class with my predator right there. And there was no counseling support that was provided to me. And actually, there's no file. And he had written me elaborate letters. Those were confiscated. They were taken away by the high school principal. And I was just, I was encouraged for being quiet, as though I had said I would be quiet. You know, I remember him saying, "Thank you for being quiet," as because my silence was just assumed. And it took me a long time to process the nuances of that. And through writing, I was able to see the systemic architecture of that, of, you know, an older authority figure, a male authority figure whom I had been trained to respect because he was my high school principal, him and his abuse of power in that situation, where even the sentence, "Thank you for being quiet," without my even saying that I would be quiet, that's an abuse of power, because it's telling a young girl who's already so susceptible to anything that a male authority figure will tell her, to tell her, "Thank you for being quiet, go back to class, thank you for not saying anything." So he just used this very specific kind of language to twist my silence, as though it's like twisting my arm, right? And so I went back to class, and I had to spend the remainder of that school year with that bully, with that predator. And what I did do was I just took it as information and life experience, because it further fueled my conviction that I had to do something about this. Because like I had mentioned, already by the time I was 17 and 18, I had already become so, I was already so aware of the systemic injustices that are thrown at women and girls. And, you know, when this had happened to me, it was the same time I was applying for colleges. So I knew that I had to apply to very feminist schools and to be a women's studies major. And so that's what I majored. I majored in women's studies and theater because I wanted to be a voice for the stories and souls that had been silenced. And it is straight out of the Me Too movement, because here we have a story about a girl who was, and actually I was one of the 5% of children who come forth, because it's actually that's the statistic, that only 5% of children come forward with their stories of abuse or harassment or any kind of sexual trauma. And I'm also part of the very narrow percentage who are actually believed and then silenced. So it's, you know, I learned about all of this in college. I learned the language, and language is empowering. And that's why I became a writer, because, you know, when these experiences happen to us, and they happen to so many of us every day, every minute, the wound is felt in three folds. The first is a voicelessness. We just don't have words for it. We just feel the pain, and then we are almost speechless by the pain. The second is a loneliness. We feel so lonely in our pain. And the third is a feeling of insignificance. And so to heal the wound, it's a three-part healing, actually. And the first is regaining your voice to counteract the voicelessness that comes from trauma. I initially became a writer to create language for myself, to give words to the things that had happened to me. And I realized that every time I'm able to gain the language to be clear about what had happened, that takes care of so much of my own healing. And that's why I knew I had to publish this book, because by providing a language for others, it helps them to regain their voices, to go on that journey of healing, and to finish that arc of the things that happened to us as children, that things that happened to us as young adults, where we found our voices being kidnapped. And I use the word kidnapped for a reason. And then it is upon us, as you know, when we arrive I'm in my 30s, we go through a sense of reckoning, and we realize, you know, I have to regain my voice. I have to end this cycle, beginning with myself and then hopefully in service to others.
Did this consciousness through writing, processing your traumas in this way, did this occur at a specific moment in time in college when you realized, this is how I'm going to express my voice, this is how I'm going to get my message across? Or was it something that happened over time?
It was over time. It was gradual, because initially, so I had, you know, taken playwriting classes, and I'd always kept a a journal ever since I was I was about 10 years old with my first journal. And I hadn't the goal for the longest time to publish my own work. I didn't think I was capable of that. Again, because of the objectification I'd been exposed to from the time I was a little girl, I thought that my service to the world, quote-unquote service, was just my physical body and my face. And that's why I went into modeling and acting, and I thought that the best I could do would be to be a vehicle for other people's words. I truly did not believe I had the mental and intellectual capability to write and publish my own work. And that was part of the trauma, part of the conditioning I had been exposed to. So it wasn't until I was in an abusive marriage in my mid-20s where I started writing with even more ferocity and frequency. I was waking up every morning with these essays that were just in my brain waiting for me to download them onto my laptop. And I started to realize the connection that the more painful that relationship grew, the more words were pouring out of me. And I realized, oh, whenever a human being is in danger, their inner voice will begin to speak all that more persistently, as if to warn us, to comfort us, to protect us. Because what is the human inner voice but our survival instinct? And so I was waking up with these essays that were elaborate debates and exposés on love, compatibility, partnership. And these essays were also, they would take me into my history as a child and my history with trauma. And it started showing me that if pain and wounds are left unhealed, those can metastasize into a toxic attraction and loyalty to abusive relationships, abusive situations, and abusive habits. So those essays started giving me clarity about how I was able to find myself in that relationship. Furthermore, because so much of an abusive relationship, it hinges on gaslighting, the person you are with who is being cruel, one of the biggest things they all use is gaslighting. And gaslighting, for those who are listening and don't know what it is when a person says, you know, I'm doing this for your own good, and they'll try to manipulate you into thinking that everything you think and do and say is actually illogical or stupid, and they'll twist every action and every word into a way for you to feel insecure about yourself. The goal is that the more insecure they're able to make you feel, you'll become that much more dependent on them and that much more susceptible to their control. So it's an abuse tactic. It's a manipulative tactic. So I would be exposed to his daily gaslighting. And then these writings that I was, these chapters of a future book, I began to realize, they started showing me the subtext and the truth behind the gaslighting. And it was almost like the armor I built up to withstand what he was trying to do every day. Like he would do something cruel and try to spin it and pitch it to me as though he was doing it out of love. Or he would say, you know, whenever you do that, it's really presumptuous for you to think that people want to hear your opinions. I'm saying this only out of your own good. I don't want you to be perceived as arrogant. So he would just spin things that way, and I would just watch him, and then I would write those things down. And so it was during that time where I started to notice that because these writings were filling me with so much awareness and insight that was in turn giving me the courage and strength to speak back to him, I realized there was value in what I was writing, and that if and when I was able to get away from him, if I spent time developing those essays into chapters of a book and then developing that book into something to publish for the world, it could be of value and service to others. So he and I, we separated when I was 27, and I just leaned into the writings and I kept on writing. And it, you know, being in communion with the words every day and feeling their value in my own life gave me the permission and encouragement I needed to leave the acting career indefinitely, because I had also started sensing that when you're an actress, especially an actress of color, the number of roles that are out there that are truly empowering roles or are vehicles for empowerment for society are very limited. And if you want to create incredible work that spreads good and intelligence and empowerment in the world, you need to take that agency. And I realized that instead of going to these auditions, hoping against hope that one day I would be able to book a role that would allow me to spread strength and courage in the world, what if I just cut out the middleman and created that work myself? And I realized the profound metaphor for all of us, which is when the world fails to provide the opportunities or the role or the relationship that you crave for your fulfillment, it is upon us to create that instead. To genesis our own role and to step into our own power without waiting for permission from somebody else. And so that's what I did. I left New York and I came to Portland because my mom and my stepdad live here. And I lived with them for about a year and a half, and I wrote this book and then kept on developing it. And here we are. It came out February 5th. And I'm so pleased. I'm so grateful for the impact it's having on people. I'm so grateful that people are letting it in and using it as medicine in their own lives, using it as encouragement for their own voices.
So you've just published your first book.
Yes.
Do you see pivoting into screenplay writing or anything like that? You
Yes.
said that you majored in theater.
When I sat down to write I Am Yours, because the formal training that I have is acting and writing plays and, you know, reading screenplays and analyzing them, I use that experience to develop a manuscript for this memoir. And so I love hearing from readers that it feels so alive on the page. And so many readers have told me that for some reason, the only way for them to read this book is to read it out loud. And I have loved that because I wanted to create language that felt like poetry. And poetry is something you need to read out loud to feel it in your bones and to feel it in the space around you. And I did sit down with a very specific goal of turning this into a movie one day or a series, you know, a television series, a Netflix series of some sort, or perhaps an hour-long Netflix special kind of thing, like Hannah Gatsby. And a lot of people have made that correlation, which I love, of course. The way I do my readings, I don't really do readings. What I do is I memorize portions of the book and I perform them. And we call it spoken memoir instead of spoken poetry or spoken word, because that's my acting background. And I wrote these stories in the book for them to feel alive in the space around us. We are in talks right now. I have a wonderful writing partner who is out in LA, and she's a producer, and we are, let's just say, yes, things are really exciting.
That is very exciting.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You work with Girls, Inc. in the Pacific Northwest. Have you noticed any particularly insidious or reoccurring issues facing women and girls at present?
You know, it's the biggest issues that have plagued the planet since the beginning of time, which is messaging and people and systems in society telling them that they are not good enough, that their voices don't matter. And so our work at Girls, Inc. is about directly combating that and telling girls they are enough. They are more than enough. They are strong, bold, and smart. And their voices absolutely matter. And each girl, each person, each human being is a leader, is a change agent. I love working with young people because it's about preventative care versus retroactive medicine, and to hopefully interrupt and intersect a young person's path before the cruelty of the world has made them become silent, and to nourish their spirit before that happens, so that, or as that's happening, to let them know that, no, I am enough. I do matter. My voice is important in this world and I should use it.
Do you believe feminism functions as a universal concept across the world, or in your experience, can it manifest in varied ways?
It manifests in different ways because patriarchy and misogyny manifests in subtly different ways around the world. And so does racism. And I think racism and misogyny, because they're all part of patriarchy, based on the certain kind of misogyny and the certain kind of racism, the feminism will have to be different. And I use the word have to because we should make sure that our feminism isn't just something conceptual, but is on the ground and addressing precisely the issues and causes that need to be addressed in that particular community. And that's what we mean by intersectional feminism, by inclusive feminism, and by intelligent feminism, is that taking it off the textbook page and making it something that's actually based on what's happening in that community.
And you spoke earlier about the way that feminist consciousness mm-hmm. was kind of passed down from your mother to you,
yes.
and the duality of this. Have you noticed generational differences in the way that feminism is experienced and talked about?
Absolutely. I love that question. It's such a nuanced question. Thank you. Well, in the same way that feminism will change depending on where you are in the world, feminism will change depending on the community's needs and how to address those specific needs and the community's injustices and how to address those specific injustices. In the same way, I believe that the conversations are different from generation to generation. For instance, you know, in America in, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, the big conversation with second wave feminism was about getting access to birth control, which we called the pill. And that was the big movement. And thankfully, we do have access to that. But again, reproductive rights is still a conversation we need to have and a fight we're still fighting because, you know, abortion is illegal in many places around the world still, and it shouldn't be, and it shouldn't be criminalized at all. And we still have so much just the social consciousness that needs to evolve for that. So I think, yes, it's kind of a yes and no answer to that question where the causes are in many ways the same, but they evolve based on the time or the community that we're addressing. Similarly with education and making education for women and girls and female identified people around the world, making it a universal right, not just a choice. And I think that's the big step we are still trying to do in many parts of the world, including my own country, Bangladesh, where education for female identified people is still seen as an option for the family to choose versus an absolute right and necessity and a law for all families to send their children of all genders to school. And so, yeah, it's the same causes and the same fights, but every generation has to fight them in a different way, I think, to be truly effective and for the impact to be sustainable.
Could you speak to your series Love Letter Mondays and what it represents in this age of technology really permeating through every level of our lives?
Right. Thank you so much. So Love Letter Mondays is a series I do every Monday on Instagram and Facebook. I post a love letter, a public love letter. Usually I'll take a story from my life or a story I've witnessed out in the world, and I'll share wisdom from it, and I'll try to share encouragement and courage for others to use. And it really is this public love letter. And I started that because with technology, especially the internet and our different phones and apps and all of that, there is the risk of creating disconnection and breaking eye contact with fellow human beings, literally eye contact, and then also that spiritual eye contact of making true, deep, vulnerable, intimate connection with people and pausing and asking each other, how are you doing? Tell me. And making each other feel seen and heard and understood. And so to counter the, you know, any kind of disconnection that is going through the world, all my work is about connection and about radical vulnerability and radical empathy and radical love. And so I started this love letter series. And, you know, Even I Am Yours is written as a love letter to the reader. It starts with the words, dear love, because I think that's, at the end of the day, love is the thing we are all craving. And it is the healing agent for so many of the things, so almost everything that we go through. The opposite of love is apathy, not hatred. And the other feeling that is the opposite of love is fear. And I think we suffer from either apathy or fear. And to help those wounds, we need love. So I will do anything I can to spread love in the world. And whenever we disconnect from each other, that's actually the first way to go toward prejudice. Because when we distance and disconnect, we become cut off from the humanity within ourselves and the humanity within someone else. And I think that's why people have become all that more susceptible and capable of attacking each other online, because they are breaking that eye contact, the spiritual, emotional, and physical eye contact from someone. And so I will do everything to counter that and to provide medicine in an age where we are all really struggling. There's a lot of chaos going around. There's a lot of disconnection. And so how do we all use our voices, use our resources, use the amount of power we each have in our own nook in the world to be agents of love?
That was Rima Zaman speaking to us about her new book, I Am Yours, released February 5th by Amberjack Publishing. I Am Yours has since been adopted into the North Clackamas School's curriculum and become a bestseller at Powell's Bookstore. Zaman is an Oregon Literary Arts Writer Color Fellow. For KBOO News, I'm Emily Gresham Beamer. Thanks for tuning in.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 11th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen The Big Sick. This screening benefits the Bus Project. Again, that's The Big Sick, showing Monday, March 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of the film Hippie Family Values on Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. at Darkside Cinema in Corvallis. Filmed over a period of 10 years at a remote communal ranch in New Mexico, Hippie Family Values is an intimate chronicle of a handful of hippie elders along with their adult children and grandkids. The director will be in attendance. Again, that's the screening of the film Hippie Family Values.